This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Now, let's start with, you graduate from college. What's your first job?
Okay. So as I said, I started out as a neuroscience major, and it was because I had done these two 85-page theses on dream analysis. And when I actually first presented it, I was a junior. I was the first junior to do this type of a dissertation. And when I presented what I wanted to do for my field study, I presented it to Columbia Presbyterian. They actually laughed at me, they told me it was a human brain study and that I would need an MD PhD to conduct the study. And I know, in hindsight, I realized it's total gatekeeping because I was not going to slice people's brains. I mean, the neurosurgeon would have done that. They would have conducted the study. I was just overseeing it. It was my concept and my hypothesis that I wanted to test. They told me that it would probably be statistically significant and I'd probably get a Nobel Prize, but not to bother because by the time I would go through the schooling required that they would probably have already done it.
It's so annoying because the schooling can truncate your creative impulses to think outside of those boxes.
I think it did for me for sure. I do not, like, college was not the best experience mm-hmm. for me. I learned way more in high school when they gave me the free rein mm-hmm. to, kind of explore what I was interested in, pursue those various paths. So I started college in neuroscience major and I ended up, because I thought I would do that, continue that path, but I ended up switching to philosophy and majored in philosophy. I came like one class shy of minoring in psychoanthropology. And if I had known that I was that close, I would have just taken another class. Yeah. I had no idea. I was just interested in it. So I graduated and I was thinking that I was going to go back to school, but I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And so I was looking for just like fun things to do in New York City for the summer. I really just wanted a break. I had, before I went to college, my mentor, who was the founder of the Association for the Study of Dreams, she went to Princeton and she at the time was actually dating the dean of admissions. And she told me, she said, I will write you a letter of recommendation. She pretty much was like giving me I don't think she could guarantee me, but it was a pretty sure thing that I would go to Princeton. And she said, but my one requirement is, the caveat would be that you'd have to take 6 months off. And she said, I don't care what you do. You can go to work. You can, travel, whatever you want to do, but you have to take 6 months off and not go straight to school. And my mom said, there's no way, because she thought I would never go back to school, which I was so upset because I was like, do you not know me? I mean, yeah. I basically do that now. Like, yeah. I'm basically back in school. Like, yeah. It was so ludicrous, but so I didn't. And when I graduated, I was like, at this time, I really did want a break. I was like, I need to just do something different. And so I was looking for dance and gymnastics programs in the city. And I stumbled upon a movement class at Stella Adler. And as a little kid, I had always wanted to act. And it was something my parents did not encourage at all, because they're like, you're having enough trouble with the kids at school. I don't think we need to put you in the public eye. But I had a very vivid imagination. The whole idea of, being in the, entertainment world, really just in the fictional, like, creativity
yeah,
world.
Yeah, you're creative.
Really what I was thinking. Yeah. Yeah. So that's what I was thinking. I wasn't thinking so much about being in the public eye, but of course my parents being, doing their job, protecting me, said, no, we're not doing that. So I found this program at Stella Adler and it was right before I was graduating. I took a trip down to New York City and I auditioned for it. And of course I used a monologue from Electra from one of Sartre's plays. Just like the worst thing to use. It's very intellectual. It's not, it doesn't translate very well.
Yeah.
It's something visceral. You know, it's very heady, which, can be done. Yeah, but
Shakespeare would have been better.
Yes. Shakespeare is guttural. Yes. That definitely would have translated better.
And your acting really matters.
Yeah, exactly. But I did it. And it was interesting because the response from the guy who was auditioning me was, okay, it's very clear that you've never done this. You have no idea what you're doing. And he said, but I can see that you have some raw talent. Mm. And he said, if you're willing to work really hard and know that you're going to be in a program with people who've been doing this since they were 3 years old, then, you know, we're willing to take you. And I said, okay, sure. But what surprised me most about it was that I thought it was going to be a lot like, I had a lot of public speaking experience because I had done these two essentially dissertations in high school. My high school published both of them. You had to present before a panel, and most of them were neuropsychiatrists. You know, they were professionals in the field. It's like 45-minute presentations. I was on the debate team. You know, so I had done a lot of very public academic speaking. In college, I was given a grant that I had to defend. And so I felt like, okay, it's going to be like standing up and giving a speech. And it was nothing like that. but what it reminded me a lot of was gymnastics, because in gymnastics, you do all this preparation. And then in that moment, the music goes on, like floor routine, for example, the music goes on and you just have to let that all go and trust that it's there and be present in the moment. And that's what it really reminded me of. That's the best way I can describe acting. And there was something really terrifying about it, but also just really exciting and, you know, invigorating, because I felt like it encompassed so much of what I had spent my, you know, childhood academic career doing, was exploring the human psyche, whether it be from philosophical, the psychological, you know, but that's really what I was curious about. It was the human psyche, the human experience. But now as an actor, you're forced to embody that from a visceral perspective.
That's super cool.
And so it kind of encompassed all of that. And also I just felt like it would give me access to learn about things I would never be able to otherwise.
Oh yeah. You know, what a cool experience. How long was that program? Like time.
So that one I did the summer program at first, and I thought I would just do that. And then I would, you know, figure out where I wanted to go to school, what I wanted to do, you know, what was I going to be when I grew up? And I still don't know if I figured all that out, but, you know, we're not sure we ever do. But then I really loved it. And so I kept going, and I did the Stella Adler program. I did these, it was right after college. And then I did the, I worked with a scene study teacher, and I worked with her for 10 years. And it was a very intense, she was trained by Stella herself and Larry Moss. So she was trained right under some of the, you know, really pioneers of the field. So yeah, so I worked with her, and it was because I was taking commercial course, and a friend of mine kept bringing in like all these like real books, you know, like acting books and scene study books. And
did that help at all? Can you learn acting from a book?
Well, she was studying like scene study, and I realized I was in her commercial class, which is very different. That's a very different, it's acting to some degree, but it's, you know, it's much more formulaic. And I was in that class, and then I had gotten like some invite for a SAG audition, but you had to do a monologue. And so I was like, okay, I think I need a coach to work with me on this, because I don't want to do what I did to audition for Stella Adler, because that was awful. And so I asked her, like, you know, who she worked with, because it was obvious she kept coming in preparing for scene study class. And so I went to work with her teacher, and that was Lynette Sheldon. She worked under Stella Adler and Larry Moss. And so, yeah, I worked with her for 10 years.
Wow. And I started for 10 years. So wait, what did you do over those 10 years? Were you working and making money and also learning? Like, what exactly was that about?
So the Stella Adler method is that you're really not supposed to work for 2 years. You're supposed to be in conservatory. This is like the old school.
It's like Freud's psychoanalysis or whatever. Like you go to your own, like they're for 10 years, they're self-analyzing. I forget what they call it, but psychoanalysis maybe.
Like the method, method acting kind of. I was not a huge fan of method acting, honestly. I think that it's a very self-indulgent, very narcissistic. Not to say that, because the thing is, you're always going to draw from your own experience. I mean, we can't step outside ourselves unless maybe you're a dissociative personality, but really, like, we cannot step outside ourselves. So we're always coming from our own lens, our own makeup, our own, you know, genetic makeup, our own personalities, our own, and just our own day-to-day human experience and our psychological makeup. So that's always impacting. We are the vessel for which to channel the characters that we play. And to, you know, hopefully do it in a way that serves the through line of the author's intentions. And that's the job of an actor. So I just felt like method, not that I think it's great to have it as a, like, I always think of it as kind of like a toolbox. You know, if you have that in your toolbox, there are times where it's very useful. But the writer, most likely, unless they're writing about your story, didn't write about you. So I think it's a little bit, I think it's a little shallow. It's limiting to make it about you. So you can use your life experience. Yeah. You can use your life experience to help, you know, facilitate and help to inform, but to make it about you doesn't make much sense.
I don't think this is exactly what you're talking about, but I always think it's funny, like people say Tom Hanks is a great actor. And like, no, Tom Hanks is just Tom Hanks if he were in the army, Tom Hanks if he were a crossdresser, Tom Hanks if he was a train conductor. Whereas Glenn Close, and I always cite this Saturday Night Live appearance she made where in every single scene, I was like, oh my gosh, Glenn Close is a lesbian? Oh my gosh, Glenn Close is an opera singer? Oh my gosh, Glenn Close is a murderer? Like, you know, like every single one, I was just, it seemed like it was her, but she was a 100% the thing she was supposed to be, different accents, different looks. She looked taller sometimes. She looked smaller. Right. Like, that was real acting, in my opinion. I imagine she's well-trained, but...
A great example of that is Kate Blanchett. It took her a really long time to actually take off. And part of why, so when you start your acting career, they tell you you need to typecast. And a lot of people get very offended by this, but really it's because somebody like her, the part of the reason it took her so long to be quote unquote discovered or to launch is because the casting directors never recognized her. Because
wow.
She really, yeah. And like she was, to me, that's a true actor. That's a consummate actor. Somebody who can really embody wow. So much so that they embody the physicality of a character and you don't recognize that person anymore. They have really taken on the role. So
being super smart and having acting experience, those are flags to me. Those are flags. Anytime I hear somebody like, I'll look at that. I'll look if a politician was an actor. I'm like, oh, so this person was good, like Stacey Abrams. She was a physics major, an acting major, and some other thing. And I was like, oh, they were deciding whether she was going to be Neil deGrasse Tyson or a politician. You know, like, but they had the acting in there. She went to a performing arts school. And I always think that's what it's for. But I still feel like you're what you see is what you get. So let's see what you did next. So then, how are you eating? How are you making ends meet? I mean, do you have a little money in the bank?
I started out mostly in theater.
In New York?
In New York. I started a theater company. And it was awesome. So I was, you know, doing theater, odd-end theater kind of jobs. But mostly what I found with theater is it's a lot like independent film. This is how I got into film production also. Mostly what I found out is that money gets tied up and it's usually what holds everything back and stalls. And a lot of times funding falls through.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of very naive and I would, you know, be very kind of annoyed, like, you know, I chose to be an actor so I could play. And why are we stalling my playtime? Mm-hmm. So I'd be like, what's going on? What's the holdup? And they would tell me, like, there, little girl. You know, we need this money. We need this location. We need this set. We need these props and all these things that they need. And me just being kind of like, not starry-eyed, like, I want to be famous. It's just kind of like, okay, well, I want to play. What do
but
I need
business,
to do?
And, business is so important. Cause and effect. I mean, you have to realize, like, those were basics that had to get done.
So I said, okay, well, if I get these things, then will I get to play? And they're like, yeah, there, little girl, you know. And I would do it. I would be like, okay, I'll get, you know, the location. I would get the props. I would build relationships, work deals. And they said, okay, well, now you're a producer. And I really was kind of naive going to all of this. And I was like, oh, okay, but do I still get to play?
So this is a lot of, and we see this in your work today, communication skills and interpersonal skills, which you're so great at. You're the only podcaster I can think of who I actually had a phone call or two with offline, like for no reason but to chit-chat, like an hour and a half of chit-chatting with a couple of podcasters, like you kind of want to
I don't do that with everyone.
But I said a couple of things to you, like I'm, you know, have whatever personal, like, oh, I'm so stupid. I shouldn't have said that, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, no, not at all. That's completely fine. I was like, wow, like this chick's got charm. Like, and it made me feel good, you know, like it made me feel fine. Like I felt like, because a lot of times you don't know somebody very well and you just kind of, or for me, because I never stop talking, by the time I'm finished, I hang up and I've said like 10 stupid things, which then haunt me for 2 days straight. So, but not so with you. So you have a lot of interpersonal skills, a lot of communication skills, obviously some business acumen if you were actually getting things done. To what do you attribute that?
Well, I started a lot of businesses as a very young kid. So I started like a car wash. I mean,
did your parents encourage it or anything?
My dad did. My dad very much did. He was very encouraging of like entrepreneurship and, you know, exploring, and that you should go and figure out how to navigate. And he was a huge proponent of it. So I had like a car wash business and I was a kid. I started a babysitter club.
Nice.
Like and a business. Yeah. So I had like other babysitters working under me. I started 90210 paraphernalia, like sales. And my dad helped me with that. Like he was very, you know, much behind that. So there were a bunch of those kinds of things. So I think that mindset, you know, was definitely ingrained in me that you could, you know, be entrepreneurial.
But the experience is important too, not just the mindset, but you had to actually have experience of doing those things in order to be effective.
Yeah. So I did do that. I did a lot of, at the time when I was acting, I did a lot of odds and ends jobs. So I did a lot of temp work. I did a lot of,
barista.
Well, you know, so as a temp, my favorite temp job was, I think it was Liz Claiborne, but it was basically stocking their inventory. And it seemed so like mindless, but I got to see all the new clothes that came in, you know, and I got to sort them
all. And they have a petite section, if I'm not mistaken.
They do. Yeah. So, that was actually one of the most fun temp jobs I did. But I did all sorts of, I did promotional modeling, like, and it's not nearly as glamorous as it sounds. Sometimes it is. Sometimes you're like in clubs and, you know, or like, you know, photo shoots. But most of the times it's standing out in like, you know, freezing temperatures, shivering, handing out flyers, you know.
Right.
That's considered promotional modeling. So I did a lot of that. I did do cocktail waitressing. Bartending and waiting tables was very hard for me because I couldn't hear.
Oh, yes. I can imagine. You know,
it's loud. It's dark.
That's so all that was I really ever did, hard for me. But yeah.
I did do some cocktail waitressing. I did a lot of like, you know, the door. I had dated a promoter, so I did a lot of, I was very involved in the club scene.
Yep, cool.
With that, you know, and I did a lot of like the cash at the door and coat check. I worked for the Grand Havana Room. That was great.
You would
money,
look great
by the way.
In a pillbox hat.
In a what?
Pillbox hat. Isn't that what the coat check girls used to
wear? Oh, yeah. I never had to wear that. But
that's at the like the Rainbow Room on top of Rockefeller Center. They always have the pillbox hats and very Art Deco. So I could see you doing that.
Yeah, well, coat check was great money. The Grand Havana Room has two. They had one in New York, and then they have one in L.A. The L.A. one obviously doesn't have a coat check, but the New York one, yeah, but the New York one did. And you know, it's a lot of like politicians, celebrities, and people with a lot of money. And not all of them, but some of them tip really well. So, but it's a hard job. You're standing on your feet. I was usually wearing 4-inch heels or more platformed for 12 hours sometimes at a time. Yeah.
But still, that's smoke. Real. I actually like cigar smoke, but that's real money. Yeah, that's why I always waitressed and stuff, because it was real money. Anything that like they had to multiply your hours by like a number, no.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
No.
The temp work was not very good money, but it was, you know, it was pretty steady and reliable. And my most steady, like if you look at my resume during that time, particularly in New York, the thing I did the most was bookkeeping, which is kind of weird. But I was usually like an assistant to accountants.
Well, that'll help with your business acumen. So you moved to LA at a certain point. Was it right after your 10 years with the...
Pretty shortly after that. So I had encouraged my mom to purchase an apartment in New York City. And I just knew it was going to be such a good deal.
Yeah, right.
Like, I knew as the salespeople said to us, it was a 2,000 square feet, 1.5 bath. And Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
I was like, so this is, they tore down the master bedroom because, as they explained, it was a Japanese company. It's funny, you were talking about it, you took Japanese. I tried to teach myself Japanese in third grade. I didn't get that far, but
it's not easy.
There was a Japanese company, and they told us they, you know, came to three times a year, no live, no sleep, just party. And so they tore down the master bedroom to have a big, they had a bar. It was like an open party space. It was beautiful. You know, right above the MoMA. So it was overlooking the, overlooking the city, midtown Manhattan. Yeah. So it was beautiful, but it was pretty cheap for what it was.
Right.
And I knew my mom was looking anyway, but I was like, you should take this.
Yeah.
Because I was like, I think this is going to, we could easily put a pop-up wall for pretty cheap and, you know, sell it for a lot more. So, we ended up, you know, buying contiguous ones, and I became like property manager. So it was always the running joke that whatever guy I was dating at the time, his job was to help me move my everything over to whatever apartment was vacant.
Yeah. So exploiting that resource stream since you were like three.
Yeah.
Okay.
After 2000, it was right before the crash of 2008. And, you know, we had a pretty good instinct to sell at that point.
Great.
And it was kind of the running joke because, you know, I had lived in a Fifth Avenue apartment and I became homeless, but I really was. So I was living. Because I was there. It's like, you know, I just shuffled into whichever one wasn't rented and I managed the properties. And I was living back and forth between my parents and my sister. And I started looking places, but I really couldn't afford to buy anything. And New York had gotten so expensive. And then, you know, the market crashed. And it was, so it was just not a great time to buy, to even rent anything. The rent had just skyrocketed. And I thought about it pretty hard. And I was like, well, I mean, I can't really spend the rest of my life crashing between my parents and my sister. You know, that was a... somebody was not going to survive. So
right.
I was like, this is not going to end up well. And, really, that's not what any of us wanted for ourselves anyway. So I thought about it and I was like, well, I always wanted to go out to LA and I had been booking a lot more film. So it was an interesting thing. I really prefer theater, but I lend myself better to film. My acting teacher always said, like, the people in the back row have no clue what you're doing. Like, as a theater actress, it doesn't translate very well. But she said the nuances were my talent. And so she said, if we had a camera zooming in on you, we know exactly what's going on. And so I was booking some film, but it was all independent film that doesn't really pay very well. It's not very consistent. And at the time, there wasn't a whole lot of work in New York for film. There was more TV then.
Yep.
And so I moved out to LA and I didn't actually tell my parents I was moving. I did an acting program, it was a 3-month workshop. And I told them it was a little bit longer than sleepaway camp and that I would be home pretty soon.
Well, because you didn't know, maybe you would have been.
Yeah. And I packed up a bunch of boxes that I had in my parents' garage. And after the program, I called my dad and I said, you know, those boxes in the garage? And he said, yeah, we need to do something. Your mother is driving me nuts. We have to clean this up. And I said, well, you can ship them because I'm going to stay.
They must have been devastated.
I think my mom really was. I think so. But I think I needed to explore. Yeah. And so... LA was pretty tough.
Well, I'm looking at your IMDb.
Yes.
And it looks like, you're a chic woman in The Magnificent Coolie, which got 7.7. That's super
cool. So that was really
Cooley
a bummer. That was the role that gave me my SAG card, The Magnificent Coolie T.
Yeah.
Apparently, they had some sort of legal issues, and the film never got distributed. I think it was distribution issues. So
it was highly rated.
Yeah, I was supposed to have 2 lines in the movie. They ended up giving me 8, like on the spot, which is, in film SAG
one
world,
is
that's
good.
A big deal. Yeah, exactly. So that was a big deal. And the director, we had a really good rapport. I was really looking forward to working with him more. And it was, I was pretty devastated that that never came out, but it was what I got my SAG card from. And from there, it was just like, it was this, I moved into mostly producing and I started chasing this project. So And why am I blanking on the name of it? I think this is just I can't believe I'm blanking on it. I'm almost like I want to look back and see if I can find the name of it. Of this film that I was became
that's
my
not
baby.
Here on the IMDb site.
No, it never got me. Fade Out.
Okay.
Fade Out was the original name. It's kind of silly, but the story was like very pivotal in my mind. I was blonde for most of my time in New York. So like platinum blonde, you know, and so I moved. So right before I had moved to LA, I think I dyed my hair red. And so I was like pretty fire engine red. And after these things are a big deal, you know? So I, because it has a lot to do with your casting, like how are you going to be cast, typecast? And so I was getting cast a lot when I was blonde, I was going, a lot of the roles were like, you know, ditzy cheerleader, which is fine. But I did a lot of like self negotiating. And I found that dealing with the, the executives, the directors, producers, they would get very confused. And I actually don't blame them. I don't really fault them for this. This is just kind of how it is. I know a lot of women would tell me I'm a bad representation, but I'm not really a feminist, so it's fine. But they were just kind of confused. They're like, why is little blonde cheerleader negotiating with me? You know, like they just really couldn't wrap their heads around it. And they would get almost like angry. I could see that.
As envious as a girl like me would always be growing up, where I was definitely by far the darkest girl around in my circles as a kid, always really, you know, I mean, I'm not going to say jealous. I think I definitely was jealous. I'm not sure envious or jealous is the right word. The blonde girls. I mean, I just wanted to be blonde. Like I just thought life would be so much better if I was skinny and blonde, obviously.
Right.
So, however, I have met some blondes who have said that it just like people don't, they just assume you're unintelligent and inside, you know, being underestimated can be an advantage, but a lot of times it's just impossible. Yeah.
I thought it was an advantage actually.
Okay.
But because, you know, I could really play that and, play that to my advantage. But I noticed they were so frustrated and it's like, cause they didn't know what to do with me. And I ended up putting my manager, who he became like my big brother, we're very close in business because he really wanted to represent me. He kept telling everybody I was like, that I was his model. I'm like, I'm 5'1". Like I missed that boat by a foot. I'm not a model, but I'm an actor. And if you want to represent me, we'll have to teach you the business. But I realized pretty early on in the business that just having a man, even if I told him exactly what to say, that if he did the negotiating, it would be much better for me.
As a mother, I've had that experience. So I have two sisters who basically raised their kids as single moms, more or less. And I feel so bad for them when I think about when push comes to shove with something with my kids' education and having a special kid, it's just going on forever.
Yeah.
Or anything like that. My husband's very busy. He's got a, you know, job, works long hours, but I would say, hey, you gotta come to this meeting or you gotta just call this guy because I don't have time to mess around and they'll just respond to you. And it's 100%. I mean, 100%. It's very clear. It's ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, I had that experience at Ethan Allen recently. I was just like, hold on, you know, this is not right. I'm sending it back. And they're like, no. I had my husband called and literally they didn't even, but they're just like, okay, what's your address? We'll come pick it up. I was like, what? And actually it was Restoration Hardware, which my friend called Frustration Hardware because anyway, they did resolve in the end. Yes, I'm very happy with it all. I don't want to throw them under the bus, but I also don't want to throw Ethan Allen under the bus. But I'm just saying, like, even in regular life, that seems to be true most of the time.
And I didn't really have any, like, I had no resentment about it. It was just like, okay,
no, me neither.
Logistically makes sense. And so I will have him. But I did decide that it might make more sense to be, you know, going after different roles. So I went red first, but then I was like, I had been in LA for maybe 9 months and I decided that I was going to dye my hair brown back to my natural color. I remember on the way home, I was like stuck in typical LA traffic, you know, and I was hungry and I was like, I really want to get froyo. And I was like trying to figure out there were two places I could go. And I know you being in LA, you'll understand this. So I'm thinking,
Pinkberry or Red Mango?
No, the place doesn't exist anymore. The place I really wanted to go. And the other one, I think, was Pinkberry. But the place I wanted to go doesn't exist anymore. But the whole debate was, okay, you have to make a left turn and there's no light there and there's traffic. So I might not make it. And then I would go to the other one. But I decided that, traffic parted. There was a spot waiting for me and I went, you know, it was all meant to be. I walk in and there's this guy from the minute I walk in who starts, and I do think he was just a little bit off, but like very socially awkward, starts asking me a million questions the minute I walk in the door. And just as I'm like about to walk out the door and I thought I made a clean getaway, he stops me and he says, "Are you an actress?" I'm kind of like everybody in this town. Yeah, I know. Like, how much more cliche could we get? And I was like, yeah. And he says, "Oh, well," he turns to the woman sitting next to him, who apparently they've been sitting there all day. And it turns out they grew up like a town outside of Chicago, like in the same town, basically, or like a town away from each other. And he said, "Well, maybe she wants to read your screenplay. You've been asking people all day and she's an actress." And I was like, okay. So I was just trying to be polite. And I walked over and I said, "Well, here's my card. You can email me." And she hands me her card and it said created for and by people with disabilities. And so I know. So I was like,
could they tell you had disabilities?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think so. But I was like, what's this all about? She was kind of like pretty jaded and a little bit, I could tell a little bit bitter. You know, she was kind of like, why? Does that matter to you? Yeah. And I was like, well, yeah, it's actually very personal to me.
Yeah.
She said, why? And, you know, I gave her kind of cliff notes. I'm like, well, I'm hearing impaired, I'm visually impaired. You know, I had a patch over my eye over the other day of my childhood. And, they told my mom that she could always find a nice institution for me. So yeah, this is relevant to me. And she said, could you play totally blind and totally deaf? And I said, let's play Helen Keller on stage in New York City. Yeah. And it was a really hard role for me because
Helen Keller, true story?
I think it is.
Really?
I do. I do think she was used as, I think she was used as an operative, but I do think.
All right, because I feel like a little bit like Stephen Hawking's, like we have absolutely no idea what he really thinks about the existence of God. We just know what that little computer says he says.
Oh, yeah. Well, I have less confidence.
You know, Anne Sullivan, we know what she thinks about everything because she's the mouth, right?
Right. Well,
anyway, sorry.
I do think she was used. I think she was used as an operative. Okay. It might be pretty hard for me to think that she was not real.
Sorry, I didn't mean to do that to you.
No. I'm open.
Sorry, I'm super cynical.
I think she was.
Just keep moving. Okay, so you did.
But
so you connected with this.
It was a really hard role for me because for most actors, it's an exercise in sensorial deprivation. But for me, it was an exercise in allowing me to relive some of the most traumatic experiences of my entire life that I had spent my life trying to get over.
Yes, so, I love never thinking about bad stuff.
Yes.
Like, I'm not a proponent of like, let's get it out. I'm like, you know what? No.
Me? Yeah. I'm like, let's move on. Let's.
Unless you have an alcohol problem, you really don't need to go back.
No. Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of, but I was like, but I think I'm pretty sure I could play it. You know, I've done it and I kind of lived it a little bit. So, or close to it. And she said, well, you're actually physically right for the female lead. So maybe you'll be interested. Would you like to read the story? So I read it. I read it like in an hour that night. I was like, you know, really, it read like a novella. It was not really a screenplay. It definitely needed a lot of work. But then she told me that she had this like producer who was going to help and he was going to get the male lead and he was already really interested. And so I had this whole conversation with him that night and after talking to me for a while, he's like, well, I think I want you to help me produce it. I ended up working with him for 2.5 years and he was brilliant, a complete sociopath, like literally. I mean, I later found out he'd been in and out of jail for minor things like money laundering, Ponzi scheme, embezzlement, fraud. But he was brilliant. I think it's one of those really just mentally ill because he was a hard, hard worker and he was so smart. That if he had applied those, you know, I think it was the thrill of doing. Yeah, I think it was the thrill of doing it, like the underhanded getting away with it. He just couldn't help himself, but he ended up. We built this. I worked with him for 2.5 years. We built this like whole infrastructure. that had 8 subsidiaries under it. And I started bringing on like friends of mine to work, but we weren't making any money and they were on commission. And at some point I called them all and like told them that, you know, I don't see any money coming in and I can't like in good faith, like you're obviously welcome. But so for a while I was doing all of it myself. Like he would call me 2 a.m. to do work. So it was.
Oh, maybe he was bipolar.
I think he had a lot of issues. But the script, the concept was really something I was so passionate about because her whole mission was, you know, they have all this, like SAG now has all these diversity, you know, inclusion, requirements. And she's like, but they never do anything with disabled. I mean, you know, she was saying how I think like, you know, gay or at the time, because now it's the trans, but like at the time should are representing something like 25% of the media. And it's, you know, it's like a very small portion.
It's 5%.
She said, but the disabled actually make up, you know, a significant portion of the population. And you almost never see them represented in the media. Point. And when they are, they're not being portrayed by people with actual disabilities.
Was this Fade Out that you were working on with this guy? Okay.
Yeah, this was Fade Out. And so,
And you never started filming? Like there is nothing on the cutting room floor?
No, there's nothing. I really spent the 2 years shopping it around.
Getting
the money. And I really thought, and this was the most devastating moment was, so if in the industry, they have something called like a lottery. And you can enter to get like tax credits. And it's very hard to get in LA, obviously, because it's a very saturated market. And I made it into the lottery. They called me. I will never forget this. And I'm like immediately start hysterically crying because we had just lost the money. The money was never there. But, you know, I thought it was and then found out it wasn't. And they were so nice, actually. They said, well, we'll give you a few more weeks if you want to go and source more funding.
Wow.
And I was like, I spent 2.5 years trying to get this funding. Like, that is not going to happen.
Did money materialize and this guy took it or?
No. What happened? I don't know. That I'll never know. Right. So what happened was he had this deal with some like Saudi guy, like Taher Tehran was his name. And they were working through the UK. And so I went and had this big meeting in the UK. Like I flew to the UK. I brought my accountant with like the film accountant with me. The writer came with me. And we took this trip and we had this whole meeting and then we opened up the bank account. And, then when we were supposed to do like the deal after the bank account, they never showed up for the meeting. And then they did all these phone calls and they were like, don't worry, when you get back to the States, it's fine. Like everything's set up and, you know, we'll just do the transfer. And so I set up this whole account.
Oh my gosh.
And then I got to the States and I it was a few weeks later, I got this email at like 6 a.m. saying that the funds could not be transferred. And it did say that I thought it was the IRS, but I don't know. I don't even remember. But it's obviously
definitely
the whole thing
sketchy.
It was
sketchy. Yeah, that sucks. Wow. And that's a couple of years of your life and emotional. And I just feel like that's very hard. It must be very hard to get over. And you have gotten over so much in the past, yet you're one of the few people who are positive. I'm positive, but it's hard to like be as immersed. You're even immersed in scarier stuff. I'm just reading the news. You're reading like the Tavistock white papers. Like you really, it's amazing. We have to talk about the white pill, but let's talk about your next step professionally or even just, you know, what you decide. Is this when you started just really full-time focusing on fitness and sharing that?
So that was right about at that time. So I took.
Because you can control that. That would be something that, you know, you're going to get the benefits of that.
Exactly. So I kind of started to walk away from, I was really just demoralized. I started another production company right after that with a friend of mine. There was another project that also did not get off the ground. It was called Princess Pooch. I just think that one had so much potential in terms of, monetary reward. Like it was, it had all of the, you know, the hallmarks. Like it was a movie about a dog and it had like the fantasy fairy tale. It was a children's film. It was really cute. And it wasn't like, you know, it was actually just a children's fairy tale. It wasn't like dark, like Disney or, you know.
Right. Promoting. Did the mother die in the first scene?
She did not.
Wow. It'll never sell.
It'll never sell.
That's what people want.
It was an intact family. That was what we were working on. We ended up parting because she really wanted to do horror films. My whole thing was I wanted to do family values films. And she, in terms of business, had a better idea because horror films are a really great business model.
Oh, yeah.
They're cheap to make. They sell
they're
like
huge right now.
Yes. And they have an international market.
I don't like them because they reinforce this culture of death, which I did not realize was so, you know, so profound. And my mother would always say, she always work against abortion, like pray to end abortion, go to the abortion clinics and stuff. She always just focused on pray for world peace. She means it in a real way. And then in her last days, like she was totally opposed to hospice, and I realized that she just had a real moral problem with euthanasia, even to relieve profound suffering. So someday I'll tell you about like her last couple of days, but she was just really, really opposed to that. Yeah, and it taught me lessons. She wouldn't like tell you like this is why. She would just say, I'm not doing that. And that's when we were praying for her to not suffer. And she said, don't pray that I don't suffer because I might suffer. Just pray that I can take it. And then I realized what she was saying was, don't give me like the button to push. Do not give it. I don't want it. I don't want to be tempted. Yeah. Don't. And I realized like even seeing her through to the end that like natural conception to natural death is so, it's such an important connection to, you know, life, to each other. Yeah. Keep your feet on the ground. It's like, I didn't care about chemtrails at all that time. You know what I mean? I didn't read the news. I didn't care. And that I realized was like where, and I've always thought this, where the powers that be are so wrong is that they just don't understand the animating force of humanity. And maybe they do understand it because they want to break that bonds down. And I feel like, and I'm not telling people like, don't press the button, don't do hospice, don't. I mean, because that is such a personal situation. Right. I would say, think about it.
Yeah.
You know, don't rush into it. But I really learned so much just from that. And then I started to understand what she meant about the culture of death.
Yeah.
And the horror movies and like really gruesome, bloody scenes. And you'll be watching a regular show and they'll just make it totally gruesome to get you desensitized to it. So I'm opposed. I don't like it. I don't like it from a really cultural moral
I get it. I've
point.
Never, I've, yeah. And I think I felt very similar. So I really wanted to do family values films. And so we ended up parting ways and, you know, we're still very good friends, but you know, we realized that it doesn't make sense to continue the business venture. But that wasn't the next one that I was really working on was Princess Pooch and didn't get off the ground. And so at that point I was pretty demoralized. You know, I had picked myself up after the whole, his name was Phil, but after that whole being scammed and, you know, being completely devastated with, because that was my baby. I mean, it was such a personal piece, you know.
Were you going to play
love
interest?
Yeah. I mean, it was such a personal piece. At this point—
Is it too late?
I think I'd be too old to play her, honestly, now, but—
There's nothing wrong with, I mean, you could adapt it to being just
a
little bit older.
Yeah. I would love to see something happen with it just because it was such a, obviously such a personal piece for me.
Yeah. And it was good, right?
It was really good. The script needed work for sure. Like I said, it was written more like a novella, but I mean, directors write scripts on set. So it absolutely could have been adapted. And I think the concept was fantastic. So I started to leave that. And I had kind of around that time, I had tried out for American Ninja Warrior.
I saw your audition for that. And I could not believe you didn't get on. You're just like, I'm deaf and blind and hypotonic and look, I can fly. It's like, wow, this chick's amazing. I can't believe you didn't get on it.
I was really, really upset. That's also another, like, I've had a lot of like losses that I've mourned, but
but you still pick yourself up. That's why you're such a good, like, you know, inspiration.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I don't know that you have a choice. We just have to keep going. So, but yeah, that was really it with that. So I had, you know, when I didn't get picked to run the course, that video had leaked. And I, you know, he was actually the lawyer I was working with on Princess Pooch, but he was a friend of mine. I had auditioned for him a decade earlier, and he always called me the diamond in the rough. And, you know, we were very close. And he called me up that morning. It was like 6 a.m. And, you know, of course, it was, 9 o'clock in East Coast time. But he called me and he said that he had seen my video for Ninja Warrior. And I thought, well, I had sent it to 6 people for feedback because my ex was an editor and he had done the video. But he told me I had a 2-hour window the next day if I wanted any changes to be made. So I sent it out, and it was back then to have anything upload and render. I mean, just on my computer, it was going to take 72 hours, which I didn't have. But Facebook, wanting all of your data, you know, makes things very easy for you to upload. And so it took even 10 minutes on Facebook, though. That shows you, you know, how big the file was.
Wow.
So it was, uploaded it, made it private. And I did make it private. And I sent it to 6 people. And one of those people was the one who called me his little sister, who was my manager, and he shared it publicly. And so when my lawyer called and I said, yeah, I sent it to you, he said, no. He made it public and it's, you know, it's now been seen. So I thought I was going to just take it down. But at that point, 3,000 people had already seen it overnight. And, you know,
did that disqualify you?
So I don't know that it disqualifies me, but what he said to me, because he was a writer and a filmmaker, and so he's very much in that world. And he said, I don't know. He said, you're perfectly legally fine. You say it's a submission video. There's nothing wrong with you, you know, sharing it. He said, however, knowing your story, he said, what's kind of, you know, like most people, you hear their story and then you see them do stuff and it's like you root for the underdog. And he said, with you, I feel like it's the reverse. It's much more interesting from a filmmaking perspective, just from a storytelling perspective, to see you do amazing feats and then hear your story. But if your story is already told, then the reveal isn't there.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So he was like, I have a feeling that you just won't get picked because now it doesn't have that, you know, impact.
That sounds right.
And so I will never know. But when I didn't get picked, I was very devastated. And I gave myself a 6-week period to mourn. And I didn't do pull-ups for 6 weeks. This was, you know, a big deal.
That was your punishment to yourself,
pull-ups? I emotionally couldn't handle it.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
it was
really
emotional. I was like, I can't do it. I need to just take some time off. I mean, I trained, but I didn't do that kind of training.
Yeah. What do you do on your time off? Lay around and eat ice cream and drink old fashions or like what?
Well,
you switch from push-ups to sit-ups.
I mean, I did still train, but I just wouldn't do that kind of training because it was like, need the space. So but then after 6 weeks, I was like, okay, I think I've had my pity party. It's time to pick myself up.
And when was this? What year?
I was 2014.
Okay.
2014. Yeah. So,
okay.
But then I thought I came up with this concept and I was like, it would be amazing because I was like, I really wanted to look at what are the positives I can take from this. Because, you know, you take hard lessons from life, but those aren't always the most motivating and, you know, they don't help you propel forward always. So they're important to learn. But I really wanted to look at what was something really positive I could take from this experience that would catapult me to, you know, move on with my life. And so at that point, what I realized was that people overwhelmingly were telling me how inspired they were by my story. And I was like, well, I don't really find me all that inspiring because, you know, I live with me day in, day out, and I find me kind of, you know, annoying. But I was like, wouldn't it be awesome if I had a conduit, like a show for athletes with disabilities? It could inspire the audience and they would feel rewarded and vindicated. So I started interviewing. I had a couple of friends who were athletes with disabilities. And, you know, I started reaching out to others and, you know, just I was very immersed in that circus community at the time, doing like acro yoga. And I started doing the silk so that I could train for Ninja Warrior and work on my grip strength. So I had outreach in that, you know, community. And I started talking to them and I realized like most of them did not move they moved because of. And that's where I came up with my premise that all human beings are designed to move. The ways in which we do are unique creative expressions. And so that kind of shifted the premise. And I started the show called WIM, What is Movement? And it was really just like people's stories. So
What kind of a show is that? A YouTube show or
so
what?
So it was a YouTube show. I have no access to it now because YouTube has taken down my channels. And that was actually a separate channel, but I can't get into it because they recognize the IP. And it doesn't seem to matter what computer or what phone. I can't seem to get into it to even take down those videos. And not all of them were put up because I obviously couldn't, you know, continue.
There's nothing controversial about those. It's just what you did later.
Yeah.
So let's talk about 2014 to 2020. Yes. Try to get that in now and then maybe take another like pause and then we'll talk about because the dividing line. I have a little funny comment about that. But let's talk about that just briefly, that 2014 to 2020 period.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can take an actual break. If you want.
Yeah, sure. So I then started doing more like fitness related stuff. So I was working on that show WIM. And then I started, like, I had my personal training certification years ago. I'm like, I have a ridiculous amount of trainings. I did real estate in New York. Like, I did e-commerce. I mean, I've got a lot of certifications. So
I love certifications and credentials. I love it. Like, if you've got nothing to do or you've got downtime or you're, like, depressed or anything like that, I just find that to go. Some people get tattoos. I like to get,
certification.
Yeah, certification. I just say, and it makes you feel good. And it doesn't go away. Like, I always thought my sister lost her job. I was like, you should get an insurance license.
Yeah, like,
why insurance.
Not?
I was like, you could sell insurance online. She's like, why would I want to? I was like, well, you probably will never get to do it. But if 6 months from now you still don't have a job, you're going to be able to make some money. I mean, that time is going to pass anyway.
Right?
And like, and then like 18 months later, she didn't have a job. I was like, you should get an insurance license.
So I had my personal training certification. I had let it lapse. But, you know, it was something I did a little bit here and there in New York. I mean, I did all sorts of, like I said, personal styling. I did actually staging for when I had my real estate license. The more fun thing to do, actually, was to stage the sets for open houses. I did a lot of, like, interior design, that sort of thing. But anyway, I started CrossFit, and I fell in love with that. And I was like, oh, I should get my CrossFit certification. And so I did. And then it really was kind of random, but I knew the owner of the gym and the 5 a.m. class, like coach didn't show up. And I lived really close, like used to walk. And I told him, I said, you know, I happen to have my L1, you know, your CrossFit 1 certification. And I was like, if you ever need somebody to fill in, like, I'm happy to do it. And so that led to me working as a CrossFit coach. And I ended up working in another gym and doing some, you know, personal training. So really, that kind of became, but we just went through like my life story.
Well, no, we didn't even get to the good part yet. So you were, you had CrossFit, yes.
Yes. So I was coaching CrossFit and that really kind of consumed my life. I mean, I ended up working, you know, like the 4 a.m. shifts. I was working the evening shifts. I was training clients in between.
Was that costing you money at this point or were you actually making money? Because a lot of this stuff sounds like you weren't making money, but you're putting a lot of effort in.
Yeah. I was putting a lot of effort in. So I wouldn't say made a whole lot of money doing that. I mean, it was supplemental, you know, it got me by. Training clients makes a lot more than coaching CrossFit, obviously. Okay. So training clients was, that was helpful. It's a lot of time, just the driving in LA, because one of the gyms was in Los Feliz and then one of them was in Santa Monica. And then in rush hour traffic, it was a lot. And so at that time I was also very engaged in the aerial world. So that paved the way for me to start. And then right before COVID is when I was really starting to book speaking and performing.
About,
for
like, just about your fitness stuff, like generally, specifically, motivation?
Well,
my speech was
motivational, but my speech was really about movement as a metaphor for life. So it was really centered. I was using my story as a testimony, but it was really centered around how, you know, I wrote my college application essay. My life began as a series of challenges. And since then, I've continued to seek out emotional, mental, physical, spiritual challenges to surround. And I think that really is true, but all of us are, you know, faced with challenges. That's life. And, you know, they look differently for each of us. That's our unique path. But I think that having something so concrete, You know, there's just, it's like the example of just like doing a push-up. A lot of times when I would work with, especially female clients in the beginning, a lot of them couldn't do push-up and they would think that they could never do one. And then you just take them through the progression and they're able to do it. It's so incredibly empowering. And it's something, it sounds kind of simple. It's just like this one, you know, physical task, but sometimes it's even just completing the workout that day. So I just realized that I know for my own life, and I used my life as story as a testimony for it, but it was also just working with others and working with clients and then working with, you know, even the ninja community, watching that, you can see how applicable it is to other areas of life.
Is this speech available? Do you have it as a video or did you never record it?
I do. The only recording I have, I think, is a really recent one. It was back in, I think it was 2 years ago, I did an event with Jay Dyer. And it really would have made sense for me to go first and him to go second. He was really funny because he said, he was like, so all that like hope and inspiration that you just instilled, I'm going to take all that away.
Oh, that is a shame. That does stink. I hate that. I hate when just like, oh, if I only had it to do over again.
Yeah. And I mean, he was wonderful. I don't want to say, I mean, he did a phenomenal job.
You don't want to follow that. Oh, no, he was following you, right.
He followed me and he did it because I wanted to film, I do a live stream for mine and he did not want his live streamed. So we reversed it. Like, so he went after me, but it was just kind of funny. Yeah. I mean, cause he's a comedian. Yes. So he's like, well, all of that hope, you know? So get ready for the doom. Mm-hmm. But it was I think we did a great job of making it relevant, like connecting the two. Cause really my whole message is just about taking personal ownership of your health, personal sovereignty. And, you know, I feel that in a lot of ways, that's what I did through physical training and that it was able to carry out to other areas of my life. So that's really what I spoke about. And the aerial is just to show people what's possible when, you know, nobody thought it was.